on 88.1 WIPR. I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. There are about 2.2 million people who are incarcerated in the United States, many more than are imprisoned anywhere else in the world, equal to the combined prison population of both China and Russia. In a new book, a law professor from California writes about the more than 81,000 inmates who are kept in isolation from other prisoners, with almost no access to sunlight, activities, or other human beings. These are the people imprisoned in a SHU, the Security Housing Unit. They are there for a variety of reasons, and some of them are kept there for years, even decades at a time. Keramet Ryder's new book examines the reasons that so many people are kept completely segregated while in prison. It's called 23/7, Pelican Bay Prison and the Rise of Long-Term Solitary Confinement. Keramet Ryder joins me for Midday, right after these headlines. And welcome to Midday, everybody, on 88.1 WIPR. I'm Tom Hall. Today, we're going to have a conversation about an often forgotten group of people, those who are among the 2.2 million individuals who are incarcerated in the United States. It's an enormous number of people, way more than anywhere in the world. The prison population in America is equal to the combined prison population of both China and Russia. And in a new book, a law professor from California writes about the tens of thousands of inmates who are kept in isolation from other prisoners, with almost no access to sunlight, activities, or other human beings. These are the people imprisoned in a SHU, the Security Housing Unit. They are there for a variety of reasons, and some of them are kept there for years, even decades at a time. Keramet Ryder joins me in Studio A. She teaches at the School of Law at the University of California, Irvine. Her new book introduces us to some of the people who live in the Security Housing Unit in an infamous prison in California. It's called 23/7, Pelican Bay Prison and the Rise of Long-Term Solitary Confinement. Keramet Ryder, it's great to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me here.
Thanks for being here. You can join our conversation as well. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. And our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. So Pelican Bay, a prison in California that some of the inmates refer to as Skeleton Bay, built in 1989. Tell us about this place.
So Pelican Bay was one of the nation's first supermax prisons, built to keep people in long-term and often indefinite solitary confinement. And it has 1,056 beds for that purpose. So this is a large-scale facility looking at semi-permanent isolation. And what makes it a supermax is that it's technologically modern, both its scale and the sort of technological innovations there. So it's made of these poured concrete cells that are kind of tessellated together into pods of eight, and an officer in a central control booth can look out over multiple pods at a time. So it's a modern panopticon where the prisoners don't have any windows at all, lights are on 24 hours a day, they look at a blank white wall, but officers can look into 48 cells at a time.
Is the entire prison comprised of solitary units, or are there also some areas where there are people sharing cells?
So Pelican Bay has this 1,056-bed isolation unit and then a few thousand prisoners in high-security general population where they can congregate together on a prison yard or share meals. So it has basically kind of two separate facilities on the same piece of land, essentially.
So people use the terms high security, maximum security. Some white-collar crimes are often, you end up in a minimum security prison. What's the difference? What's the scale there?
So prisons in the United States can go anywhere from kind of a facility where people might work in jobs, in factories or in call centers, have kind of what we might see as a more normal life. They spend a lot of time with other people. Sometimes there aren't even really secure perimeters around some of those facilities where people might have normal jobs. That would be a minimum security facility or the kind of white collar place you might think of, all the way up to these places like Pelican Bay, where people are locked in an 8-by-10-foot cell 23 more hours a day, every day, and don't have any human contact, let alone seeing natural light, grass, sort of the things we think of as part of normal life.
So they are isolated by themselves for 23 hours every day. The lights are on the whole time. What do they do in that other hour?
So usually they're allowed out, and an hour a day is kind of the average. In practice, if they're lucky, they get out for 2 hours every few days. So maybe in a week, you might get out two or three times. And in that period when they get out, they're allowed into an exercise yard, which is known colloquially in California as a dog run. It's about twice the size of that cell, and prisoners have described it to me as like being in the bottom of an empty swimming pool. So it's basically kind of like an empty concrete box with a little bit of natural light. Prisoners in California went on hunger strike a few years ago to protest these conditions of confinement. And one of the things they asked for was a wool cap when they went out into this dog run, and maybe a ball or something to do while they're out there, because mostly you can just pace when you're there. So prisoners would go out to that, and they have a sink toilet combination in their cell. But if they need to shower, that happens in that little bit of time when they're out of their cell. But even when they're out, that officer in that control booth who looks out over multiple cells at a time is just pressing a button to open one door at a time. So it's not like even in that interaction of getting out of the cell, there's still no human contact. It's all automated. You know, one door opens, another closes, and they go out alone to this exercise yard.
And you describe contact with their families, for example, as only happening when there's some dire emergency at home. I mean, they're not permitted phone calls home or phone calls to loved ones the way that the rest of the population is that correct?
Exactly. So in general, they're not permitted phone calls at all in these kinds of conditions of confinement. Interestingly, on a radio show, I should say, sometimes there are radio shows in these areas where prisoners know at you know, 8 p.m. on Sunday, their family might be able to call in and have a message on the radio show. They develop in these really rural areas where these prisons are. But that can be the extent of their contact with family for years at a time. If family do visit, which can be really hard in these places, Pelican Bay is a good 8 hours from San Francisco, 12 or 13 from Los Angeles. So if the family can even make it up there, they would visit behind bulletproof glass. So people talk about going years at a time without shaking their sister's hand or hugging a niece or a nephew who's been born. So it's, you know, that aspect of it can be especially tough.
Why are the people who are in solitary confinement placed there?
This is often the surprise when I talk about this. People aren't there because of something they did outside of prison. So the assumption can kind of be, oh, these must be the worst of the worst. They committed some horrible crime, and then a judge or a jury said, well, you should go to solitary confinement. But that's not how it works at all. In practice, people only end up in solitary confinement because of something they do inside prison based on decisions made by staff and guards in the prison facility. And sometimes it's that they broke a rule, like they had a weapon or they participated in a riot or they had some kind of contraband. And then they usually get sent to isolation for a fixed period of time, anywhere from a few months to a few years. But states that have used isolation for really extended periods of time for thousands of people, like California, like New York, many of the states around the U.S. have been facing criticisms for this. A lot of times people end up there because they've been labeled as dangerous. So they haven't even done a specific thing wrong. They haven't broken a rule. They've just been assigned as dangerous, often because they've been labeled gang members.
So they're labeled after they get into prison. I mean, obviously, many of these people are dangerous on the outside. They've been convicted to serve time in a maximum security prison. But when you say labeled as dangerous, so they've got a gang affiliation, what other reasons?
It's almost always a gang affiliation. Sometimes it's that they're having trouble following prison rules because they're mentally ill, although increasingly there's legal protections to keep the seriously mentally ill out of isolation. But the gang affiliation thing in California was based on the tattoos you had and who you were hanging out with on the prison yard or even what you were reading. If you had three pieces of evidence in your prison file, any three, you know, you were reading the autobiography of Malcolm X and you had a tattoo that suggested you were a gang member and you were hanging out with some African-American guys on the prison yard, that was enough to get you sent to isolation indefinitely in California up until some reforms that took place last year. And those kinds of policies that, you know, things that we think of as general First Amendment rights kind of are checked at the door, and then prisoners end up in these places. And because of that, actually, these aren't always particularly bad guys. I tell the story in the book of someone who went to prison on a third strike conviction for a very small amount of drugs right after three strikes passed in California. So it was his third felony. He got a life sentence, had never committed a violent crime, was mislabeled a gang member and sent to isolation at Pelican Bay, stayed there for more than 10 years until a judge overturned his three strikes conviction as disproportionate, and he was released directly from isolation, having, you know, never committed a violent crime in his life. And we don't know how many people there are like that, but given the number I was able to find, it seems like there's you know, it's not insignificant.
That's another thing that you find when you read this book, is that it's difficult to really even ascertain the number of people who are in solitary confinement. So the prison officials are not obligated in any way to give a running tally at any given time of who's in the general population and who's in solitary?
There is very little information across the U.S. about the details of how many people are in solitary and why. And in part, that's just because prison systems are run by states and jails are run by counties, and everybody has a different name for this. And in fact, the more solitary confinement gets criticized, the more prison systems have an incentive to give it a label that sounds a little less like solitary confinement. And so even if there are published reports of the kinds of security levels people are in, it can be very hard to figure out which of those labels are isolation. And so, you know, estimates range in the U.S. that anywhere from 20,000 to more than 100,000 people are in these conditions of long-term solitary confinement, and we're just not sure exactly how many.
You're listening to Midday on 88.1 WIPR. I'm Tom Hall. My guest today is Keramet Ryder. She's the author of a new book called 23/7, Pelican Bay Prison and the Rise of Long-Term Solitary Confinement. You are welcome to join our conversation. Our telephone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday at wipr.org. And our Twitter handle, if you prefer that, at midday, Tom Hall. What's the racial makeup of the folks in solitary confinement? Is that different than the racial makeup of the general population?
Absolutely. So if you are a scholar of criminal justice in the United States, you know that one of the major critiques of it is that it tends to have a disproportionate racial impact, that Latinos in California, African Americans, Native Americans, minority populations tend to be much more likely to end up caught up in the criminal justice system and end up incarcerated than they are to be present in the general population in the U.S. That effect is magnified in solitary confinement. So in California, for instance, where I've looked at it, you can be as much as two times as likely to be in solitary confinement if you're a Latino as to be present in the general prison population. So we're talking about really magnified racially disproportionate effects in isolation. On the one hand, this makes sense because so many prisoners who have been labeled as gang members are ending up in isolation, and the relationship between gangs and race tends to be very close. And so the prison system says, well, we're just putting these dangerous gang members there. But then when you look at the racial breakdowns, it's pretty shocking in the states that have released data, the racially disproportionate impact.
I had a conversation, I don't know, a year and a half ago or so on another show, on the morning show that I used to host, with a guy named Brian Stevenson.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, who's a terrific guy who has done a lot of work on prisons, particularly the death penalty.
Yes.
But he's also done a lot of work on the issue of solitary confinement of children.
Yes.
He tells the story in his book of a kid named Ian Manuel, who was in solitary confinement for 14 years. I think he started when he was 14 years old, something like that. And the prison officials said it was for his own protection, mm-hmm. because other children had been put in these prisons with adults and had been sexually assaulted and, mm-hmm. and you know, victims of abuse. What do you know about the children population in solitary confinement in California or nationwide even? I know there aren't any children at Pelican Bay, right?
That's correct. Pelican Bay is an adult male facility, so there's no one under 18 there. The question of children in isolation is a pretty new question. I remember in doing the research for this book maybe 5 or 6 years ago, I was interviewing people who'd been in isolation and were now out of prison to understand how they were coping with that transition. And I asked one of the first guys I interviewed, I said, what was it like to be in isolation at Pelican Bay? And he said, well, it was nothing compared to the 5 years I spent in isolation as a kid in juvenile hall in California. And I was just floored. I had no idea, as someone who was studying solitary confinement, I had no idea we were putting kids in isolation as a country. And that's something that has gained increasing attention, especially in jail systems. There's been a lot of attention around this being a wide-scale practice at Rikers in New York. There's been a lot of litigation around juvenile confinement in California, and I think isolation is used a little less there. But this is something that I think as people look at reform, this is a place where there's a big wedge, I think, for states to say, in addition to keeping the seriously mentally ill out of isolation, can we also try to keep people who are under 18 out? And this is part of a kind of growing trend in the U.S. that Brian Stevenson has been integral to, of understanding better that people under 18 tend not to have fully developed brains, and that if we kind of take care of them and treat them well, the vast majority of them age out of their crimes even when they've done horrible things. And so, I think as we think about not executing people who are under 18 at the time of their crime, not sentencing those people to life without parole, the kind of next step is keeping them out of solitary confinement. But, it's even newer than the question of thinking about how many people are in long-term isolation in the U.S. And so I haven't seen a good count of how many people have experienced this or how common it is. And so much of this happens behind closed doors.
How about women in solitary confinement? Is that common as well?
It's less common. There are no, as far as I know, sort of single-use facilities like Pelican Bay that target women prisoners. Women in isolation would tend to be in smaller units within a bigger prison population. So that might also mean they would be there for shorter periods of time, but it certainly happens. There's one woman I interviewed for this project who had spent about 6 months in isolation. And there's a growing movement. There's, thinking about these vulnerable populations who maybe should be especially protected from these conditions, juveniles, the seriously mentally ill, and now pregnant women is another. And you hear that, and why would a pregnant woman be in isolation? But it is a thing that happens in the U.S. And, more and more there's a tension to the fact that maybe that should be a population who we're really careful not to put in isolation.
Why should anybody care about this? Which is to say, so many of these people, not all, you mentioned mental illness, which is certainly very pervasive in the penal system in the United States. But many of these people have committed heinous crimes. They've killed people. They've accosted people. They've raped people. They're in prison. The Eighth Amendment of the Constitution guarantees protection against cruel and unusual punishment. But who's to say this is, in fact, cruel and unusual? I mean, is it a violation of these convicted people's constitutional rights to be in isolation? And, of course, judges aren't deciding that they go to isolation. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The people who are running the prison do. Mm-hmm. How do you reckon those two things, that these are, in many cases, criminals who've done terrible things and society has decided that they really not only need to be segregated from the pop from society, but even segregated from the people who are their fellow inmates?
So it's an open legal question whether this is constitutional or not. It has been litigated. One of the first cases about it was in California in the early 1990s after they opened Pelican Bay in 1989. And many of these cases have involved horrible stories of the abuse that happens between prisoners in these facilities and guards who are told that they're guarding the worst of the worst, and the kinds of things that happen in terms of guards beating up prisoners, keeping them from getting medical care. And courts have kind of stepped in and said those things need to be controlled. And they seem like a kind of pathology of these institutions that develops around them. But in terms of the length of time people are spending there in the conditions of confinement, U.S. courts haven't said this is purely unconstitutional. There has been a little attention to the due process questions, these questions of whether it's okay to put someone there simply because they have a tattoo or because of what they were reading. And in California, a lot of the reforms have been around that question of let's make sure we're only sending people here who actually do something wrong and have proven themselves to be kind of a dangerous, scary person to have in the population. And so there's a policy movement that way, at least. But there's a separate question beyond the U.S. constitutional question, when there's this sort of broader question of ethics and human rights values. And there, internationally, the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture is clear that these conditions violate international human rights norms, that more than a few weeks at a time in these conditions can constitute torture. So there's the sort of, there's the question of international human rights. But then to me, there's a more important, to kind of get back to your why should we care? There are important social questions, whether we think it's legal or not. One is that it's astronomically expensive. In California, it costs $90,000 per prisoner per year to keep someone in these conditions of confinement. And we've never studied whether it works, whether it does keep us safe or reduce violence in any systematic way.
How does that compare to the cost of a person in the general prison population?
It's 2 to 3 times more. So in California, it's about twice the cost in general prison population. Most states, it costs about $20,000 to $30,000 to keep someone in general prison population, and it's usually about twice that to keep them in isolation. So we're talking about huge social costs for taxpayers who then have no ability to see what's happening there or to evaluate it. The second problem, I would say, is that because people are being sent here based on in-prison behavior, it's not affecting their criminal sentence. And that means people are being released directly directly from these conditions of isolation in many states. It's roughly 1,000 a year in California, roughly 2,000 a year in New York, coming directly out of isolation onto the streets.
Okay, so there's two things here, and I want to make sure we get them both. When you say it does not affect their criminal sentence, what does that mean? So they're not getting time for good behavior or anything like that? Or how does it have no effect on the sentence that originally got them into the prison?
So it can have a little bit of an effect technically, but what I meant to say was that when a judge sentences a person to 10 years or 15 years in prison, then prison officials decide what prison that person will serve their time in. And when prison officials send that person to isolation, even if prison officials say, oh, he's really dangerous and we can't have him in the general prison population, that doesn't change that 15-year sentence the judge gave them. And so prison officials might say, well, I don't want to deal with them. But at the end of 15 years, their criminal sentence expires and they get out. So around the margins, being in isolation can limit good time. You could get a new criminal charge there. It could extend your prison term. But the kind of baseline is prison officials send people there, and as soon as their prison sentence expires, prison officials kind of have no right. They're only protecting themselves in some sense. And sometimes they are protecting themselves from dangerous people. But then there's this sort of expiration point at which people get out. And even for the people who don't get out directly from isolation, we know there are serious psychological consequences, and people get out after spending a year or two in the general prison population. So you know, I think it's another way in which this is really important, is that these aren't the guys who are spending life in prison. Most of these guys are getting out, and we as a society have to deal with them.
Yeah, there are reasons that we should care, in other words.
Yes.
All right, we will talk more about this. My guest today, Keramet Ryder. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Criminology, Law, and Society at the School of Law at the University of California, Irvine. She's also served as an associate at Human Rights Watch. Her new book is called 23/7, Pelican Bay Prison and the Rise of Long-Term Solitary Confinement. You are welcome to join us when we come back from a quick break. 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wipr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. I'm glad you're with us. Stick around. And welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you are with us this afternoon. Coming up Monday on the program, the moral dimension of supporting the new president-elect. What does it mean to be part of the loyal opposition? And what would it take for Donald Trump to win the support of people who so vehemently opposed him in the election? That conversation coming up Monday on Midday. If you've just joined us today, we're talking about the use of solitary confinement in prisons. My guest is Keramet Ryder. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Criminology, Law, and Society at the School of Law at the University of California, Irvine. She's also served as an associate at Human Rights Watch. Her new book is called 23/7, Pelican Bay Prison and the Rise of Long-Term Solitary Confinement. She'll be speaking about her book tonight at 7:30 at Red Emma's Bookstore on North Avenue in Station North. And you are welcome to join her at Red Emma's tonight and join us this afternoon. Our telephone number, 410-662-8780. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. And our email address, midday@wipr.org. I want to play for you, Keramet, a clip from a speech that President Obama gave to the NAACP convention in July of 2015, in which he was talking about criminal justice reform. And he talked about solitary confinement in terms of the fact that it's not going to make us any safer.
The social science shows that an environment like that is often more likely to make inmates more alienated, more hostile, potentially more violent. Do we really think it makes sense to lock so many people alone in tiny cells for 23 hours a day for months, sometimes for years at a time? That is not going to make us safer. That's not going to make us stronger. And if those individuals are ultimately released, how are they ever going to adapt? It's not smart. Our prisons should be a place where we can train people for skills that can help them find a job, not train them to become more hardened criminals.
So in the case of Pelican Bay Prison, in 1995, a judge ordered changes condemning the practices there. What happened after that? Did it help?
You know, it helped a little. Some of the stories of abuse coming out of Pelican Bay before that 60 Minutes aired an expose in 1993 that was utterly horrifying about, one prisoner smeared himself in his own excrement, which is a very common thing that happens to people in isolation. Actually, they deteriorate mentally, or it's a form of resistance. People don't fully understand it, but they start getting particularly filthy. And that prisoner was dragged out and dipped in scalding water until about half of his skin peeled off. And that was kind of an anchoring story in this litigation of the kinds of abuse that prisoners were experiencing in Pelican Bay. And I think after the litigation, there was much better training and oversight to make sure that staff knew how to manage prisoners, better job keeping the mentally ill prisoners out of these conditions of confinement. And the institution became kind of much cleaner and neater after that. And you don't hear, you said at the beginning, Pelican Bay used to be called Skeleton Bay, and you really don't hear that anymore. People call it the Bay now.
So is the argument to not use solitary confinement any more based in the fact that, as President Obama is suggesting, it just doesn't work? I mean, it's not going to do anything to aid and abet the rehabilitation, so-called, of any of these folks. Or is it based more on just a humane level of, treating people? You describe folks who say these prisoners were literally treated like animals.
Right. So one of the challenges of litigation like this is that now people aren't treated as animals in that same way, where they're being physically abused. But there's a wealth of evidence suggesting that the mental effects, even for people who go in relatively mentally stable, are extreme and long-lasting. And that's, everything from hallucinating and anxiety attacks and trouble sleeping and heart palpitations to increasing research out of neuroscience that not having human contact actually changes the shape of your brain, and certain parts of your brain start to shrink. And that, this is a big experiment we've been running over the last 20 years. And, those brain changes may or may not kind of rebound after people have spent 10 or 20 years in isolation. We just don't know. But there is a growing body of evidence that it does have damages that we have trouble seeing, but that we're just beginning to try to understand.
You talk about a study that was done at Stanford University that was not done of prisoners who were actually incarcerated, but it was done with volunteers, sort of, middle class kids who were privileged, et cetera, et cetera. What did that study show?
So in 1971, there was this study called the Stanford Prison Experiment.
So a long time ago.
A long time ago, yes. And in fact, this study kind of led to a lot of changes over how we could treat human subjects in experiments, because it deteriorated so badly. But it was run by a Stanford psychologist named Philip Zimbardo, and he randomly assigned middle-class kids to be prisoners or guards. And he created a prison in the basement of a Stanford psychology lab. And he had planned to run this experiment for a few weeks and just see how they took on their roles. But the kids assigned to be guards became so abusive so quickly that he ended up having to stop the experiment after a few days. And so it kind of stands as this symbol of the power imbalances that can develop in these institutions between people who would otherwise kind of see each other as human beings. But when you put one group in cages and you give another group control over them, things can deteriorate really quickly. And I think that's what you see in a lot of these isolation facilities, especially when they first open. You kind of tend to see these horrible stories of abuse coming out of them.
On 88.1 WYPR, it's midday. I'm Tom Hall. My guest today, Keramet Ryder. She's on the faculty of the UC California Irvine School of Law. Her new book is called 23/7, Pelican Bay Prison and the Rise of Long-Term Solitary Confinement. Let's talk about the long-term part of your title. The length of time in solitary confinement is determined by prison officials.
Correct.
But is there any, norm? Is there any standard? I mean, judges are often given pretty specific guidelines about how long a person is to be sentenced to prison for particular crimes. Is there any uniformity in how long they're? Because some of the people you talk about are there for decades, it's not like they're in solitary for two nights to, be told to behave. I mean, they're there for years and years.
No. You know, there's a grid of sentencing guidelines in the U.S. that tend to affect how long your criminal sentence into prison are, but there's no such uniform grid for your term in isolation. As I said, prison systems have rules that kind of set out some standards, but for these indeterminate sentences, it can be the length of your prison sentence. So, and again, you know, unsurprisingly, since we have trouble counting exactly how many people are in solitary confinement in the United States, we really don't have a sense of the average lengths of stay across the U.S. Research I did in California suggests that the average length of stay in Pelican Bay was about 2 years for prisoners before they got back to the general prison population. But that didn't account for this group of people who've been there for decades. So when there were these hunger strikes protesting the conditions in 2011 and 2013 in California, a media information request produced the information that there were 500 prisoners in California, 517, who had spent more than 10 years in isolation in the state. So incredibly long periods of time. And now, as people are paying more attention to this issue, every month or so, I would say, I see a new case about whether 28 years or 35 years or 40 years in isolation is unconstitutional. So this practice has been going on long enough now that some courts are starting to look at whether there is a period of time that's so long that it's no longer okay. And a lot of these are sort of individual one-off cases where a court looks at an entire prisoner's history and sees, well, you know, maybe they did something dangerous 40 years ago, but in the last 20 years, they haven't broken a single rule in isolation. And they're under constant surveillance. And there are surprisingly lots of ways to break rules. Even attempting suicide can constitute a rule violation sometimes. So then, you know, when these things do get that rare external review outside of the prison system and a judge sees something like someone who's been in isolation for 40 years and hasn't done a single thing wrong in 20, I think there's some incentive to try to reevaluate those cases.
But there's no doubt in your mind that the science is clear on the deleterious effects to the human psyche when they are in, when a person is segregated from other human beings for even a short period of time. I mean, the science of this, as far as you're concerned, is really pretty clear.
The science of this is absolutely clear. The open question is how people respond and how resilient some individuals are versus other individuals. So I have talked to dozens of people who've been in isolation who have recovered in the sense that they're able to sit down and have a cup of coffee with me and tell me what it was like and how they're coping. Whether they've recovered in the sense that they're not damaged and they don't jump every time they hear a loud noise and they don't have rigid routines they can't break because they spent so long, you know, trying to keep themselves sane for 23 hours a day alone is another question. But no, I think the science is clear. Where a lot of the policy debates happen with prison officials is, okay, but how bad are those effects? Can people recover? And how do we balance that against our fears of people that the prison system labels as dangerous?
I was really interested, right in the beginning of your book, you talk about comments that Justice Kennedy made in 2015 about how there's not enough public scrutiny in this field, and obviously your book is going to help increase the public scrutiny. But you also said that the use of solitary confinement is not malicious, but it's basically the culmination of bureaucratic functioning. What do you mean by that?
One of the really interesting pieces of the story of the Supermax that I unraveled as I was trying to understand why anyone ever thought this was a good idea and how it got sort of pushed through policy channels to spend this much money keeping this many people in isolation this long was that it was really an administrative innovation, and it was designed by prison administrators and bureaucrats who were scared, who had over time were developing responses to prison activism from as early as the late 1960s and early 1970s, that they were afraid of the kinds of organizing and violence that was happening in prison around events like the revolt at Attica in 1971. Prison officials really talk back to this time and point to it as a thing that they needed tools to respond to. And so we think of supermaxes as this, especially originally, this administrative innovation. There was very little legislative or legal oversight in the first states that built these facilities. So it was prison administrators coping with their own fears and coming up with creative ways to design them. And they really were, I think, thought they were doing better than what had come before. They were building new facilities that were designed to be cleaner and brighter and less crowded. And they were worried about themselves and other prisoners' well-being, and they thought that they could do better this way. And I think some of the people who designed these institutions originally remain kind of horrified at how wide-scale they've become and how long people spend in them.
You write that between 1989 and 1993 in Pelican Bay, there were 683 recorded fights between prisoners. Mm-hmm. So that has nothing to do with, that's a separate tally than, you know, guards who may be abusive to prisoners. Et cetera. Right. Does the use of solitary confinement attenuate the number of, you know, conflicts, physical altercations between prisoners and the general population?
You would think it would. This is something that has basically never been studied. I mean, this is one of my big, you know, we spend so much money on this, and there are maybe two or three studies over the last 20 years trying to get enough data to look at rates of violence between people who've been in isolation and people who haven't. And the little bit that's been studied suggests that we just don't, there's no dramatic impact one way or another of more or less violent with a system that has an isolation unit. And then there's this question of how do prisoners even get in fights, which is, you know, when Pelican Bay first opened, there were few prisoners who were actually housed two to a cell. So they were in these cells 23 or more hours a day with another cellmate. Those people got in fights. There were some cases where officers were letting one prisoner from one cell and one prisoner from another cell out onto these tiny exercise yards and letting them fight each other. So
they call them gladiator fights.
Exactly.
Right?
So there's this interesting, you know, when you think about solitary confinement, there's this interesting relationship between not just the prisoners who are there and the guards who are watching over them, but also, you know, the institutional structure and the policies that are governing that and how people are being treated.
410-662-8780. That's our phone number to join us here on Midday. Our email address, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Karabit Ryder is my guest. Her new book is called 23-7, Pelican Bay Prison and the Rise of Long-Term Solitary Confinement. She'll be speaking tonight at Red Emma's at 7:30. Are there policies now, President Obama has changed some policies that pertain to federal prisons that don't pertain to state prisons. Tell us what those policy changes have been and how they might affect the use of solitary confinement.
So as we heard, President Obama has been outspoken about the problems with keeping people in these conditions of confinement. And one of the things he did last year was issue a rulings to suggest that juveniles, so people under the age of 18, should never be put in these conditions of confinement. Now, as it turns out, there are very few juveniles in the federal prison system who are experiencing these conditions, like, you know, probably less than a dozen. But the executive order is really important for making a point, I think, about what the standard could or should be, and is part of this growing movement in the states to reconsider these kinds of policies. So that's one big change, and it is many states are currently kind of reassessing the costs, both economic and social, of these kinds of conditions and looking at what kinds of alternatives there are. So, you know, California had a class action case in which they agreed to not use these kind of gang assignment indeterminate sentences to terms and isolation anymore. States like Washington State is in the process of trying to reduce their populations by providing more mental health treatment and program for these prisoners and seeing if they can do something even with the tough prisoners to get them out of the long conditions of isolation. So this is really part of a growing national conversation. And a lot of it is happening at the local level, which is exciting as we think about what a different federal government would look like. I think there's a lot that's already kind of in place and moving forward at the state and even local jail levels.
What about the fact that so many prisons are now privatized, that the federal government, the state governments across the country are, you know, jobbing out the job of keeping track of prisoners? Do private prisons have any more or less leeway regarding the use of solitary confinement?
And this is another place where Obama has kind of been making some important symbolic moves, I think, around returning prisons to public operation. You know, in general, private prison facilities try to bid on contracts where they think they can beat state costs, and they tend not to think they can do that in the highest security facilities with the toughest populations. So most of these supermaxes across the United States, like Pelican Bay, tend to be publicly operated facilities. That said, every prison in the United States almost has some kind of shorter-term isolation facility for prisoners who, you know, who get in a fight or are mentally ill and need to be controlled for some period of time. And we know, so one of the problems with private prisons is that they're often not subject to the same information requirements as public agencies would be. And so we know so little about what's happening in them. But, you know, certainly seems likely that they have some forms of isolation. The exposés that have been written suggest that they do, you know, they do use at least shorter-term isolation. There's growing attention to the fact that detention facilities for non-citizens tend to have even mandated isolation beds. You know, sometimes as many as 10% of the beds in a given facility would be isolation, and then they just have to fill them, whether people are misbehaving or not. So this is certainly a problem that's just beginning to be uncovered.
Dave from Clarkville, welcome to Midday. Glad you could call. You're on the air with Kermit Ryder.
Yeah, hi, thanks. I wanted to contribute a little bit to the discussion because I spent 25 years in the correctional system in Maryland, and my testimony to you is that there is no such thing as good incarceration. It's effective, but it's not good, especially solitary confinement, whether it's 2 days or 2 years. The fact of the matter is that it's dehumanizing, it's denigrating, and a whole bunch of adjectives you can think of. And I did that as a teacher. So my experience was that basically whether or not these guys had committed a crime or not, all that was true, and most of them deserved to be punished in one sense or another. But, you know, the whole thing revolves around what else is there left to do, and I'm sensitive to that, and I understand it. But I've had success on lots of different levels with these guys simply because if you can simply reason with them on a humane level, that it'll have some effect. Probably one of the best experiences I had was with a guy who was in the penitentiary downtown for a life sentence. He had killed somebody. I don't know who it was. But he was not only was he penitent, he was an intelligent guy. He was not, surprisingly, a manipulator like so many are. And what he did was he was compiling a list of library services for the institutions in Maryland. He managed to get it published. He gave commitments and dedication to several people in that instance, which I thought was, considering on the, you know, the face of all of that, a very effective and, as a matter of fact, a gentlemanly thing to do. I'll listen to whatever you got to say off camera, off the air. But I wanted to contribute that.
No.
Well, Dave, thank you for your call. That's really very helpful. I mean, that's a story you've heard before.
Absolutely. And one of the things I'm always so glad to hear from people who've worked in these facilities, too, because I think one of the things that often gets lost is that this isn't just hard on prisoners. This is hard on staff. And I think it's a place where people are just beginning to think about doing the research and understanding what would make it not better just to live in these facilities, but better to work in these facilities. And I think one of the things staff see, like Dave suggested, is that if you can find a way to treat these people as human beings and kind of deal with them on a one-on-one level, often everybody's job is easier because you don't have people throwing excrement at you or fighting you or making your job miserable and scary.
Kermit Ryder is on the faculty of the School of Law at the University of California, Irvine. She's also served as an associate at Human Rights Watch. Her new book is called 23/7, Pelican Bay Prison and the Rise of Long-Term Solitary Confinement. She'll be speaking about her book tonight at 7:30 at Red Emma's Bookstore on North Avenue in the Station North Arts and Entertainment District here in Baltimore. We've got a link to more information on our website, wipr.org/midday. Kermit Ryder, great to meet you, and break a leg with the book.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. I'll be back in just a minute with a tribute to the poet and songwriter Leonard Cohen. First, a quick break. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up Monday on the program, the moral dimension of supporting the new president-elect. What does it mean to be part of the loyal opposition, and what are the ethical dimensions of unifying the country when such a divisive figure is elected as its leader? What will it take for Donald Trump to win the support of people who so vehemently opposed him in the election? That's coming up Monday on Midday. Midday's director and engineer is Luke Spicknall. The show is produced by Rob Sivak, Bridget Armstrong, and Kathleen Cahill. Austin Coughlin from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the Midday theme music. We want to thank Eddie's of Roland Park for providing lunch for our guests today. Eddie's is a full-service market with locations on North Charles Street and on Roland Avenue in Roland Park. Their deli features unique sandwiches and salads with specials each and every day, all listed on their website, eddiesofrolandpark.com. It's Veterans Day today. Our thoughts go out to all the families whose loved ones have died in the service of their country. We thank them and we thank you for your sacrifice. One last thing before we go. The great poet and songwriter Leonard Cohen died at his home in Los Angeles yesterday. He was 82 years old. A couple of years ago, when the great folk singer Pete Seeger passed away, my friends Walt Michael and Caleb Stein came by on the morning show, and we played some of Pete's music. So for a musician, the best way to pay tribute to a fellow musician is to play his or her work. So I learned of Leonard's passing just this morning with too little time to get the band back together, so I'm going to ask your indulgence this afternoon, and I'm going to sing my favorite Leonard Cohen song. This is Suzanne. He wrote it 50 years ago, and folks will be singing it for decades to come. Suzanne takes you down to a place by the river. You can hear the boats go by. You can spend the night forever, and you know that she's half crazy. That's why you want to be there. And she feeds you tea and oranges that come all the way from China. And just when you mean to tell her that you have no love to give her, she gets you on her wavelength. And she lets the river answer that you've always been her lover. And you want to travel with her, and you want to travel blind, and you think you maybe trust her, 'cause she's touched your perfect body with a mind. Jesus was a sailor when he walked upon the water, and he spent a long time watching from his lonely wooden tower. And when he knew for certain only drowning men could see him, he said, all men will be sailors then until the sea should free them. But he himself was broken long before the sky would open. Forsaken, almost human, he sank beneath your wisdom like a stone. And you wanna travel with him, and you wanna travel blind, and you think maybe you'll trust him, 'cause he's touched your perfect body with his mind. She is wearing rags and feathers from Salvation Army counters, and the sun pours down like honey on Our Lady of the Harbor, and she shows you where to look amid the garbage and the flowers. There are heroes in the seaweed, there are children in the morning, they are leaning out for love, and they will lean that way while Suzanne holds the mirror. And you want to travel with her, and you want to travel blind, for you know that you can trust her, 'cause you've touched her perfect body with your mind. Leonard Cohen. He died yesterday at the age of 82. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening.
Now I've heard there was a secret chord that David played, and it pleased the Lord. But you don't really care for music, do you? It goes like this, the fourth, the fifth, the minor fall, the major lift, the baffled king composing hallelujah. 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 needed proof. You saw her bathing on the roof, her beauty and the moonlight overthrew you. She tied you to a kitchen chair, she broke your throat and she cut your hair, and from your lips she drew the a blaze of light.